دكتور السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله وبركاته. How are you حبيبي؟
الحمد لله الحمد لله. Today I have the great honor and the great privilege of announcing to the nation that I have met Mr. Dawji Senior. That's Abubakar Dawji's father. And to my great surprise, the father looks younger than the son.
Yesterday I met somebody in the supermarket and he said, "Hey, Abby, how's it, man?" I said, "Okay." He said, "You know what? I met your father just an hour ago and I met the son now. I'm just waiting to see the Holy Ghost."
So, how did you find the launch?
Maulana, let me begin by saying that I was impressed beyond my expectations. But more importantly, I commend and applaud the directors and management of Radio Islam for having the foresight and vision of establishing a studio here in Durban. You know, we in Durban always felt like the stepchildren of Radio Islam. The feeling was that, hey, that's a Joburg radio station. Mm. But now we feel that we are part of the family. It's now our radio station. And therefore, I can only see more and more participation of Durbanites in the broadcast. And it won't be long before Joburg listeners will be speaking perfect English like us and all. What can I say about the launch, or should I say lunch? What a chow we had on Sunday, eh? The function was a great success. Cool. Lovely speeches about media and so on. And excellent artery clogging Gajar Halwa. Kashmiri biryani and veg Afghani. What a chow. And the company was great. Eh? It was wonderful to see all the big people from Radio Islam sitting at the speaker's table. All the big people. And I'm not referring to you, Maulana. I could never say that about you. I have great respect for you because you are a Maulana and also you are 1 or 2 years younger than me. And so there I was rushing to the function from Isipingo, rushing to the function on Sunday. And as I got into Overport, I thought I heard some funny sounds coming from the back of my car. So I stopped, got out of the car, opened the boot, and discovered that it was just a wheel spanner knocking against the rim of the spare wheel. But dear listeners, I made a terrible mistake. I didn't realize that I had stopped in Sparks Road.
Ooh.
I should have ignored that sound coming from the boot and kept driving. I could not ignore that screeching sound that suddenly filled the air and must have been heard right there on the beachfront. Dawji! Hey, Dawji! Meow! The gadoot came out of me instantly. I walked over to Halima Khala's house and made salam. Dawji, what are you doing here Sunday? That shop is closed today. You came to visit me, that's so nice. I said to her that Radio Islam has opened a studio here and I'm on my way to the big lunch just now. And she said, "Oh, okay, but Dawji, wait 1 minute, all right?" She went into the house and after a few minutes she came back and said, "Dawji, here, take this ice cream cup away and bring me some food, okay?" I like to eat baked food. Dear listeners, how could I say no to this wonderful old lady? But I was wondering how I'm going to do this without looking like a first-class mafatia. I didn't even have a packet to put this ice cream container into. And it was going to be embarrassing. So while driving, I looked at this container with the big clover label on it. Dear listeners, if you are at a Muslim person's house and you open the freezer to look for ice cream, you take out the ice cream container, open it, what will you find? Ginger garlic. Open the next one, unfried samosas from Ramzan. You'll be lucky to find any ice cream at all. And I like the name, Ice Cream Tupperware. Only we Indians can create names like that. Anyway, I hid the container under a big serviette on the table and quickly pulled a Gupta on one of the waiters. I gave him $10 very quietly and he came back. And while I was talking some big shots with some impressive talks, some big motas, he came back, this waiter came back and said very loudly, "Boss, I got your chow." And handed me the ice cream Tupperware. I could have died on the spot. You know, that sparks throat color really puts me through hell. Well, in any case, I hope I collected some sawabs for doing that good deed.
We have to bill you for that, eh?
That's for a good cause, Malana. Come on.
All right. Now, the whole ICC story, what's your take?
You know, in South Africa today, the hot story is about the Hawks battling to find evidence to nail Pravin Gordhan. I suppose you all know about the huge drama, the hostage drama at SARS, where allegedly an official was being pressurized to provide information that would bolster the case against Gordhan. And it's all turning out to be quite comical. And what is becoming increasingly clear is that the Office of the Public Prosecutor, the Office of the Public Prosecutor, is being used for political purposes. In other words, it's not acting as an independent organ of state. It is being used to target Pravin because the perception is that Gordhan is an obstacle to state capture and so he has to be removed. This is no secret. The whole of South Africa knows this. And to claim that this is not true is to insult our intelligence. And therefore, conversely, if you are not insulted, then it follows that you have no intelligence. And the main O in this comedy is Sean Abraham. Sean Abraham, who is not shining very much these days. In fact, he must be wondering why he opened this can of worms. It backfired on him badly. Instead of putting Pravin in the witness box, he is now in the dog box. Pravin has emerged stronger than ever, and poor Abraham is viewed as a first-class mampara. And yesterday, a call was made by the Save South Africa campaign for Abraham's to be fired. Poor chap, he lifted the big sword to chop Pravin, but he instead chopped himself on his own head. A classic example of the double-edged sword. So the Hawks was used for a political purpose, politically motivated. It is therefore not an independent objective body that was supposed to act without fear or favor. And therefore, dear listeners, it has discredited itself. It cannot be trusted. It is being used to settle political scores. It may be doing many good things. Let me say that. It may be doing many good things. But if it does some deliberately bad things, then it is no good. Right? So, I'm laboring this point, underlining it. If you use an institution for political purposes, then that institution is discredited. All of which brings me to the issue of the ICC. Of course, there is a raging debate about South Africa pulling out of the ICC. A very heated debate, indeed. Sometimes very emotional and sometimes based on ill-informed perceptions. Let me say this clearly. After considering the issue for a very long time and hearing both sides of the argument, of course, you must have an open mind when there are issues, contentious issues. So I've come to the conclusion that South Africa is right. Yes, South Africa is right in leaving the ICC, and the reasons are many. You may, of course, disagree with me, and that's fine, no problem at all. And, of course, I could be wrong in my assessment and conclusion. But, hey, I am happy to concede this if I am persuaded otherwise. But right now, that's my position. Firstly, let me say this. South Africa and others who signed on to the Rome statutes that created the ICC should not have ratified it unless all countries came on board. Yes, I mean all countries in the world. The United States is not a member of the ICC. Neither is Israel or Pakistan or China or Japan or India or Turkey and a few others. So if this was an international criminal court, all of them should be on board. If a law was passed here in South Africa, let's say the carrying of a concealed weapon, a concealed firearm, is regarded as a serious crime, as it is in the United States, if it was passed here and it only applies to, say, black people, that law will be deemed an ass. any law that is applied selectively discredits itself. So if all the countries of the world are not subjected to the jurisdiction of the ICC, then some, to put it bluntly, will get away with murder and others won't. You get my drift? It creates great dissatisfaction, which is what we have noticed already. But what about the argument that it has done much good, especially on the African continent, where people who have suffered death and destruction have been provided some relief and satisfaction to see the perpetrators standing trial at The Hague? Of course, that's wonderful and must not be ignored. But again, I present the argument that the Hawks has done good work, but has discredited itself for being used to settle political scores. It is badly tainted. The citizens have no confidence in it. And the ICC has also discredited itself. You need to dig a little deeper to find the answers. Center stage in the discussion at the moment about the ICC here in South Africa is Omar al-Bashir, president of Sudan. Some are saying that South Africa is pulling out because our government is facing charges that it acted illegally in letting Bashir leave the country where he was here for a summit a few years ago, given that the ICC had issued an international warrant for his arrest. Not true. That case is in the courts and will continue whether South Africa is in or out of the ICC. But dear listeners, the case of Omar al-Bashir clearly demonstrates how the ICC was used to pursue a political agenda. It's actually quite breathtaking, a wonderful example of big power shenanigans. Please listen very carefully. Many years ago, in fact the year 2000 to be precise, I was lazily watching one Sunday afternoon. I was watching a TV program on SABC's Issues of Faith program. It was about Sudan. And I was horrified by what I saw. Very bad videos. I'm speaking about the quality of the videos. It looked like they were made on some cheap home camera. And this was a documentary about people in the south of Sudan being taken by the people of the north as slaves. The message was that the Arabs in the north, the Muslims in the north of Sudan, were oppressing the black African Christians in southern Sudan, and of course taking them as slaves. The whole documentary was of a very poor standard. The quality made it, as far as quality was concerned, it was unfit to be broadcast on a national TV station. Well, I was quite horrified, as I said, so I dug a little and found that the videos were produced by a Christian fellow and his brother in the Cape, who headed a tiny group, right-wing group, and they were also behind moves in the Cape to ban the halal sign from foodstuff. By all impressions, they were anti-Muslim. Well, that made me sit up. Then I began digging deeper, and I discovered that this group was linked to a bigger organization based in Switzerland and also had ties with the Baroness in England, who was always speaking in Parliament, and other organizations in the United States, right-wing Christian groups in the U.S. It's a very big story, but briefly, the purpose of this group was to generate as much propaganda against Sudan. As I said, the rich Arab North, the Muslim North, was oppressing the Christian South. This was what was being generated. It was a huge campaign. The story of the slaves appeared in the Mail and Guardian, with a front page story and a huge photograph of slaves being taken, being bought and sold. Schools and churches all over America were collecting money to pay for and thereby free these so-called slaves. It was all so well orchestrated. It was a fraud, actually. Anyway, after I saw the documentary on SABC and discovered this big campaign, I, together with the Media Review Network, took the SABC to the Broadcast Complaints Commission. We made presentations to show that this was a third-rate documentary based on false information and was not at all of broadcast quality, for one thing. So I made a very lengthy presentation providing evidence of the campaign to discredit Sudan by false propaganda. Of course, there was no denying at all that the central government in Khartoum was discriminating against the South, but everything was grossly exaggerated in the international propaganda campaign and in the media that was increasingly successful, in fact, in painting a horrible picture of the situation. North versus South. Muslim North versus Christian South. And there was a militant group, the SPLA, that's the Sudan People's Liberation Front, that was fighting government troops in the South to liberate the South from the North. Its leader was John Garang, and he was a frequent visitor to Washington. Of course, the West supported him with arms. The SPLA was clearly a terrorist organization, but hey, you know the story. If you are with the West, you are a freedom fighter, and if you are not, then you are a terrorist. You know what happened in Afghanistan with Osama bin Laden when the Russians occupied. Anyway, why the huge interest in Sudan? The answer, in case you didn't know, was oil. Yes, the oil fields are in the South. At that time, it didn't occur to me that the intention was to split the country so that the South could be independent and the oil vampires could go in and drain it out. Split the country, that was the objective. So Sudan was fighting the terrorists in the South. Then Darfur suddenly erupted, exploded in the northeast. Then we had the Sudan Liberation Army, SLA, fighting there. And by all accounts, supported by neighboring Chad, through which weapons were channeled to the terrorists from Western countries. So Bashir had a civil war on two fronts, and of course his army was therefore stretched, and he used drastic measures, barrel bombs, and so on in the South, dropped from plane. The whole thing was absolutely terrible. He enlisted the help of the Janjaweed, who just went. Were completely lawless. In fact, they were a law unto themselves, and it was utter chaos, lots of atrocities, and of course the people suffered. The people of Darfur were starving. All of this was covered widely in the international media, leaving out, of course, the atrocities committed by the other side. So the pressure was on Bashir. The fighting intensified in the South. The call was now for the South to break away and become independent. A big call, a demand was made that Khartoum government must talk to John Garang about the South being a separate independent country. Huge pressure, in fact. And the final big stick was the ICC issuing an arrest warrant for Bashir, declaring him a war criminal for committing a genocide in Darfur. Now it gets interesting. Firstly, a special UN Commission investigated what was happening in Darfur and declared that what was happening in Darfur cannot be classified as a genocide. Secondly, wait for it, Sudan was not a signatory to the ICC and still isn't, meaning that the ICC had no jurisdiction over Sudan. So how can the ICC lay a charge against Bashir? And the answer, my dear friends, is that the United Nations Security Council can refer cases to the ICC for prosecution. Did you get that? The members of the UN Security Council, one of them being the United States, which, as I said, is not a member of the ICC. How nice, eh? But you know what? It gets better. The first chief prosecutor of the court was Luis Moreno Ocampo. He was an independent player. Was he an independent player? Was he? Well, not at all. He is close to the United States and also to Israel. I don't want to go into detail about that, but after he retired, he visited Israel and said that Israel does not have much to fear from the ICC, and also gave advice that if the Israeli High Court declared that settlements were legal, then the ICC could not prosecute it for war crimes. What a nice guy, eh? Oh yes, he also charged Hezbollah for the murder of Rafiq al-Hariri in a bomb explosion in Beirut. So he is described as one who likes grandstanding, publicity seeking, not exactly the qualities of an independent prosecutor. So the case was referred to the United Nations Security Council, the case of Bashir, and predictably Luis Moreno Ocampo made a big announcement that Bashir was to be arrested. That was the ultimate pressure on Bashir, and of course all kinds of characters like the Hollywood star George Clooney and others, celebrities, got on board to demand that the South cede from the North, break away from the North. Now it is my view that the charge of war crimes on Bashir led him to believe that if he agreed to the peace deal with the SPLA and agreed to the South being an independent country, then somehow the pressure would be off him and the charges may be quietly rescinded. Well, we all know that that didn't happen. The South became an independent country on the 9th of July 2011. And since then, it's been a total disaster. And George Clooney is nowhere to be seen. And so let's look at why South Africa did not arrest Bashir. South Africa said repeatedly that it has a problem with some of the clauses of the Rome Statutes. When they signed it, they didn't realize it. And they are, and these clauses are open to interpretation, especially on the question of diplomatic immunity. That's a very important issue, diplomatic immunity. It's an internationally respected concept, meaning that any officially designated diplomat cannot be prosecuted under the laws of another country. That's putting it very simply. And by extension, that includes a head of state. South Africa asked repeatedly for this to be clarified, because the Rome Statutes were not clear on this, and South Africa quite reasonably asked for this diplomatic immunity to be a rule in the Rome Statutes. And it makes sense, in spite of the fact that a despot may be guilty of gross human rights violations. Short question. Imagine when Bashir arrived here and was promptly arrested and taken in chains to the ICC in The Hague. Imagine that. South Africa, as our foreign minister said, would be regarded as declaring war on Sudan. After all, he is the president of that country, supported by a large majority of its citizens. These are political realities. You can't escape them by quoting niceties and principles. It's not a perfect world, but. And one more thing. It's reported that Bashir and John Garang, the leader of the terrorist group, were in the process of negotiating a peace deal which would have resulted in some sort of federal arrangement for Sudan rather than splitting it into two. But the prosecutor Ocampo threw a spanner in the works and derailed it by issuing a warrant of arrest. And that underlines a point made by our foreign minister. And let me underline that also, that I'm no fan of our government. And the foreign minister said that you can't always resolve a problem by tough action. Imagine if the ANC said before 1994 that South Africa cannot move forward unless P.W. Botha and Pik Botha and F.W. de Klerk and Adrian Flock and others were arrested and tried for apartheid, which was declared by the UN to be a crime against humanity. Thousands died, huge suffering, and they didn't do that. That would be, of course, the principal thing to do, but at that time, would it have been the right thing to do? See, there's a difference. And what would have been the consequences then if that was the position of the ANC, to put these people on trial? So you see what I mean? So let me end about Bashir. There is much more to this issue, but clearly the court was used to obtain a political objective. Very briefly, let's examine other arguments against the court. The usual criticism is that African countries are unfairly targeted. That's not completely true. Of the 9 charges brought against African leaders, 5 of them were initiated and brought to the ICC by African countries themselves. Secondly, and we hear this for a very long time, why are Bush and Blair not brought to trial? Well, in the case of Bush, as I said, the U.S. is not a signatory to the ICC, so the only way that his case can be referred to the ICC is if the Security Council of the United Nations told the ICC to do so. And, of course, the U.S. can easily veto such a suggestion in the Security Council. But that's not the main reason. Britain is a member of the ICC, so the ICC can act against Blair. That is not so. What would you charge him with? That's the question. What would you charge Blair with? The ICC can only charge someone for carrying out atrocities on the field of war, meaning any soldier who murders civilians or rapes or carries out mass executions and so on. Or if a leader gave direct orders for such things to be done. Clearly, there is no evidence that such orders were given, although by Bush or Blair, although Bush did admit to something called advanced interrogation techniques, which in simple terms means torture. So the only thing that Bush and Blair can be charged for is a war of aggression. Aha, you say. Well, we got him now, haven't we? It was an illegal war on Iraq. It was based on lies, so it was a war of aggression. Yes, you may be right. But here's the catch. The concept of war of aggression is not yet part of the Rome Statutes, and so the ICC cannot act. It's still being formulated and debated right now. But when it does become part of the law of the ICC, it cannot be applied retroactively, meaning Bush and Blair cannot be held accountable. Only future wars of aggression can be prosecuted. So here's my conclusion. The ICC is faulty in many respects. It has acted at the behest of imperial powers, and therefore it is an instrument of political agenda. And secondly, it's not all-inclusive, and therefore many of the bigger rogues are exempt from the reach of its long arm. Don't be mistaken, South Africa has repeatedly engaged the ICC to reform and clarify issues, but did not succeed, and therefore chose to withdraw, contrary to the view propagated by many in the media also, that it was a sudden decision. It was not. Yes, we need an international criminal court, but not one that acts selectively. In the same way that the United Nations need to be reformed so that it can play an even-handed role in world affairs, so that all rogues and rogue countries can be prosecuted. Last night I heard the honorary UN Education Special Envoy, Gordon Brown, who used to be the Prime Minister of the UK. He was looking very cross as he made a statement about the terrible bombing of a school in Syria. Of course, it was terrible. He said this is a war crime and should be referred to the ICC. And you know what? I agree with him. Then he said that such war crimes are presently being committed in Afghanistan and Libya and Pakistan and Somalia and other troubled spots. He said this twice. I shouted at the TV screen, "Gordon, you idiot, you forgot Yemen." But Gordon is no idiot. How can he mention what happened on Saturday, 8th October, when a 500-pound bomb, laser-guided, US-made bomb, was dropped on a funeral procession in Yemen? 140 people were killed, mainly civilians, and 525 seriously wounded, including many, many children. That is a war crime, but Gordon Brown cannot condemn Saudi Arabia. Britain is selling billions of dollars worth of arms to the Saudis. So, dear listeners, let the hypocrisy end. Then only can we respect our leaders and our institutions here and on the international stage. Wa afir da'wana alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin.
Wow, you sound so academic, so professor-like.
I put my professor's hat on today.
Well done, sir. I think the chow last week did you well.
No, it was meeting you. You know, some of that wisdom rubbed off onto me.
Oh, yeah, sure. light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, some young Dhaka-roking boys were busy stealing washing from my neighbor's clothesline. And my neighbor opened her kitchen window and shouted, "Hey, what y'all doing?" As the boys ran away with the clothes, they shouted, "Auntie, we're doing online shopping." Rashid Mamu was chit-chatting with his fro, Samira, and while she was cooking in the kitchen, and he asked her, "Darling, which of your four children you like the most?" And Samira replied, "I love all of them." I love all of them the same, from the youngest to the oldest. And Rashid said, but how do you manage to love all four of them the same? And Samira replied, hey Rashid, it's because Allah has made a woman's heart in such a way that she can love all of them equally. Then Rashid smiled and said, now I hope you can understand that a man can have a heart to accommodate two wives. Next day, his four children went to visit him in hospital.
Okay, as always, Jazakumullah for your time.
Always a pleasure, Mawlana.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi
wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.